Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
So as usual, I've opened the front door and grabbed the first two likely-looking Londoners who happen to be out there.
It does seem that everyone's got a story to tell.
I think screaming does help as well.
Ooh, yes, the Horniman Walrus.
They dug out bodies in 1887, 1873.
What did he look like when he came out the other end of that?
Knackered.
Got Sarah Palin coming. How do you feel about that?
A little bit pathetic.
So we're in the parlour of Dr. Johnson's house.
One sees a story that is both of protest and of coming together.
So they're banning people from bringing food to homeless.
Yeah, they're banning soup runs.
You know, we weren't buckled by the terrorism.
A word in your eye, don't worry or push. A step in the gate is worth two in the bush.
Which area of ridiculousness do we start on with that story? Why would you give a medal to a pigeon?
Listen, you're all idiots. You know, it was my culture or anything.
No running, no throwing. This is pretty serious stuff.
You engage with other people, you link across to other people.
It's just huge. It's gigantic.
How many times have you done this so far?
That depends.
What do you think of that approach?
I think that's terrible.
London life is a really rich experience, and there's a lot that's good about living here.
Boris Johnson.
He weighs as much as 40 school children.
What a peculiar conversation. Well, hello. Hello from South Moulton Street, which, if you feel the compulsion to check it out on a map, is just by the side of Bond Street tube station in the heart of the West End. And we are in the first floor, what looks like a conference room or a ballroom or something like that. And all around us we can see artifacts. And that's because we are at the Crossrail Archaeological Exhibition. We're halfway through the construction of Crossrail now, and as with any project of this size, and certainly anything involving digging in London, it's necessary to bring in the archaeologists and make sure that we're not losing anything of historical value in the process. And this is an exhibition of what's been found so far. I'm about 2 minutes into the room. I've cast my eyes around, and the first things that I'm seeing here, well, really quite spectacular, a full skeleton. And this isn't one of those behind a glass case type exhibitions. You could reach out and touch the exhibits here if you felt so inclined. We've been asked not to, of course. One or two familiar faces from the London history scene here. Mike Patterson from London Historians is over there. He's talking to Caroline Denny, who is armed with a magnificently large zoom lens. I'm not sure what she's thinking of using that for. Perhaps she's going bird spotting later on. Ambrose Hyde from London Black Plaques is here as well. I should have thought this is all grist for his mill. Now, of course, I'll be putting photographs of all the exhibits here onto my blog page. You can check that out at www.nquentinwolf.com and go to the Radio Londonist Out Loud category. You'll find the pictures there. No exhibition of this sort, of course, would be complete without clay pipes. Much sought after, not least by a certain stallholder down at Spitalfield Traders Market, who turns them all into jewellery. You'll of course know who I'm talking about if you've listened to a recent show on that subject. Well, this is very interesting. There are some planks of wood here, not in very good condition. Of course, they've been dug up. It looks as though we're seeing what's left of perhaps iron nails, rivets, not sure what to call them, certainly very badly rusted. They form part of a clinker boat. It's a clinker built boat believed to be up to 800 years old and discovered at the excavation of a large shaft at the Crossrail site in Limo. There's a depiction here of how the fragment found here would have fit into the larger vessel. It looks as though it's a single-sailed, fairly low vessel, and this is quite a substantial portion from somewhere near the front. To give a bit of context, there's a picture here from around about the time of the capture of Richard II, and it shows a clinker-built boat there. There's a fellow in the foreground. So, I mean, this is a little bit like a canoe or a kayak or something like that. It's got slightly pointy, upturned ends. Samples of the wood here are going to be sent to a laboratory, and there they will inspect the tree rings, and they're going to discover when it was constructed using dendrochronology, which is the tree ring dating technique. And in order for that to work, they've got to keep the wood wet until the analysis is complete. So it looks as though somebody pops in here with a scientific version of a watering can every so often and tops it up. We're by a low display case now. Several smallish items here turn out to be amber of 55 million years in age. These were found at Canary Wharf, and they're quite attractive objects, glittering slightly under the display lighting. Don't know about you, but I can hardly get my mind around a figure like that. We've also got the remains of a bison. And this is a bison humerus and bison cheek tooth, the lower third molar, 68,000 years old. Similarly, reindeer, and this is part of an antler base, again 68,000 years old. So I think we'd have to guess that these are by a long, long way the oldest items here. If you're sitting in front of Google right now, it might be a good idea to check out the age of the Earth. What portion of that history does 55 million years represent? Well, here with me is Ursula Lawrence. She is a geologist. She's working with the Crossrail team. How does that work? Are you with the team the whole time, or are you called in occasionally?
I'm employed directly by Crossrail. And I have responsibility for part of the route to make sure that the ground conditions are understood appropriately, and that's incorporated into the design and the construction methodologies.
What does that mean in practical terms? There's some very business talk going on there. What do you have to do day to day?
It means that making sure that the contractors have got all the information about the ground, all the test results, that we've taken all the right water measurements, and that when we do our design calculations and our construction, that I'm flagging up to the construction teams, yes, you can do this, no, you can't do that, have you thought about these pressures, those water levels coming in through those rocks, that kind of thing.
My mind was drifting away to archaeology there, so it's not specifically about the archaeology or the historical side of it at all. No. This is very much about what the ground is doing, how
That's
the ground's
right.
going to...
The engineering properties, how it responds to the engineering that we propose to do, and making sure that the engineering is compatible with the behaviour of the ground.
Is the ground very varied as across London?
Oh, yes, it is, yes. In the west of London, we're constructing the tunnels through what's called the London clay. It's very stiff, it's hard. It's like when you open up a pack of modelling clay or plasticine, and it's great stuff to tunnel in. If you look at an older map of the tube network, you will see that the vast majority of it lies north of the river, and that's because it's all in the London clay. When you dig it out, it will stand up for several weeks, which gives you the time to build the tunnels and the stations and lay all the bricks. It's only in recent years that we've become south of the river with the sands, especially because they have water running through them. So it needed a development in tunnelling technology to be able to support the tunnels as we go along and overcome those problems.
That's fascinating. We've been talking on the show in recent weeks about this kind of north-south divide, and what public transport is one of the big ones, of course, is that there's no public transport south of the river. And there's a geological basis for that.
Oh, yes, very much so. Yes, it even caught out the famous Brunel. He had a lot of problems when he was digging his tunnels.
Very interesting. I'm really excited by this. Do you know off the top of your head how old the Earth is?
4,600 million years. No. Yes. 4,600 million. Yes.
Okay. So this it's. I wasn't quite sure what sort of portion of time 55 million years represents, but it's still a reasonable way into it.
So
these must be the oldest exhibits here.
They are indeed, yes, by a long way.
And apart from their great age, which I'm imagining must be shared by a lot of bits of rock around town, what makes these bits of amber special?
Well, the chance of us finding it, for a start. The amber was formed in a very tropical environment. Where we're standing now was at the bottom of a beautiful, shallow tropical sea. Land was off to the west, Wiltshire, West Country, Wales, Midlands, all points north and west. A forest fire affected the land, heated up the resin in the trees, made it boil, come out of the trees and drip onto the floor. The forest fire went through, the rains came, and they washed this now hardened resin along with the sand and the ash and the charcoal through the streams and the rivers, through the mangrove swamps and out into the shallow tropical sea where we are now. And then about over the millions of years, more and more sediments were laid up, and then they were gradually eroded over the remaining period of time. And then about 15 years ago, we started drilling boreholes over the entire length of Crossrail. We've drilled some 1,800 boreholes, combined meterage of about 64 kilometres. And we decided to drill a borehole, one of about 100, at Canary Wharf. They're about 100 millimetres in diameter, and we just happened to drill it smack over the top of this tiny little piece of amber that's about the size of a 50 pence piece.
So is this a rare find for you?
Oh yes, very much so. Amber in the UK rock succession is incredibly rare, and you literally do not need the fingers on one hand to count the numbers of pieces of amber in the UK rocks.
It's very exciting. Does it have a great material value for that reason?
Potentially, yes. I don't know what its value is, I'm afraid.
I mean, like later on when we make this into a necklace and flog it, you know, are we going to be able to charge more is what I'm asking.
It's unsuitable for making into a necklace because it's so old, it's very fragile, and you'd end up with just a pile of chips.
Out of all the bits and pieces on display here, what's the thing that excites you the most?
Oh, the amber.
Oh, it is, okay.
Yes. But that's because I'm a geologist, not an archaeologist.
So all of this other stuff, I mean, it's just, it's very new, isn't it? The idea of some pots over there, which are a few hundred years old, there's nothing in that for you, is there?
No. Sorry, no.
Is it even, like, anything within the time that humans have existed?
No.
That's not...
No, humans have only been around a million years, million and a half years, something like that. So this is way before humans. This is kind of like, it's about 10 million years after the dinosaurs disappeared.
So, if I'm imagining how you might see the world, I know that sort of before living organisms turned up, there was rocks for a long time.
That's right.
And this is clearly a result of living organisms.
Yes, trees, plants.
And is there a sort of a most exciting time in terms of the period, the huge majority of the life of the Earth, where it's just rocks? Is there a most exciting rock phase?
Life came and went in spurts, really, because the history of life is punctuated by extinction events. There's been five big extinction events. So you'd get lots of really exciting life forms, and then most of them get wiped out. And then you start building up the life forms again, different life forms.
Hmm.
So there are more exciting bits and less exciting bits.
Well, that's very interesting. So am I right in thinking then that amber being the product of a life form, even though I would think of that as being a sort of a rock, essentially,
yes.
But it's not, is it?
No.
But it is the direct product of the...
It's the resin coming out of the trees. It's dripped onto the ground, and then over the period of time, it's hardened.
And so you'd get different ambers according to which of the periods of life on Earth?
Yes, that's correct, yes.
I feel like I've learnt something. I didn't plan to, but I think I might just have done it.
Excellent.
Well, we're in it over the skeleton here, who is laid out in the way you would expect. Although on a table, which is probably not the way that he or she expected. And that's one question answered straight away. What we can learn from this skeleton, says a information page next to it, the shape of the skull and pelvis reveal that this was a male individual. We can see that there was a copper alloy object being held during burial, and that's judged by there being green staining on the upper left arm. And there are deposits of plaque on several teeth, so we've got poor dental hygiene and a carbohydrate-rich diet, and on it goes. So some straightforward detective work going on here. Above it is a picture of a crossrail, presumably a crossrail archaeologist, brushing away the earth from several such skeletons. And they're laid out in a way that makes them look like they've recently gone to bed. Well, with me is Ambrose Hyde of London Black Plaques, and he is taking in the skeleton, amongst other things. What are you making of this exhibition so far, Ambrose?
Well, I mean, I love the human stories, so I was naturally attracted to the skeleton in the room. It's a fascinating one. It comes from the site of the original Bedlam Hospital, which is now Liverpool Street Station. And the tantalising thing is we can't know if it was a patient or not. We believe that other people may have been buried along with the patients at the graveyard there. I mean, obviously, we may well find more from examining the bones, but it's quite powerful to think that this could have been one of the patients at the very first Bedlam Hospital back in the 15th, 16th centuries.
So the area in which they were found, this was the burial ground outside the hospital?
That's right, yes. Well, talking to the expert from the Museum of London, we can't be sure that all the patients were in this graveyard alone. They do believe that other people in the parish were also buried here. But it's a very powerful reminder of the site, really. Obviously, there's nothing left. Liverpool Street, Broadgate, the whole area is totally redeveloped. So quite an amazing find. And they're talking about some 300 of these bodies in a fairly small area.
It's difficult for me, at least looking at this, not to imagine that one day somebody might be looking at my bare bones on a table. What do you think of that when that idea comes to mind?
Well, that's true. If you've been at the madhouse, now that might be interesting.
There's time.
Obviously, Bedlam, it's become a figure of speech, the term Bedlam. And this, you know, this is just an amazing reminder of it. We often forget, of course, Bedlam was one of the prime tourist sites in London in its day. Kind of
that's true, isn't it?
Would equate with the London Eye and Tower of London today, that you would pay a token fee, you'd be let in, and you'd be allowed to taunt the patients. Of course, patients wasn't the word they'd recognise. These were effectively prisoners. Obviously, mental illness was thought to be a curse from God, so these people were locked up, and yes, you could go and taunt them.
I see, so that made them legitimate targets in a way that sort of morally legitimised the bad behaviour.
I guess you could look at it that way, yes. I mean, you could even hire them out for parties.
You're kidding?
No, I'm not kidding. The inmates would be sold out to come to your party and entertain in the manner of a kind of court fool, effectively. And, you know, tantalising to think that this could have been one of them. The inmates at Bedlam are actually called antics, which is clearly a word we recognise today. It would have a K on the end in those times. And interestingly, antic is still a surname that crops up occasionally. So if you have the surname antic, I think you know where you came from.
There's a fascinating insight here into the life of London, not that it was anything that we would recognise. We're looking at AD 200, the main Roman road to Lincoln and York, left the city at Bishopsgate, just to the east of Liverpool Street. And reading through the information here, it says to the west side of the Walbrook soil sample suggests that cereal cultivation or crop processing was taking place in nearby fields. By the medieval period, the area is known as Moorfields, a marshy area that may have resulted from poor drainage caused by construction of the successive city walls. We have found deep marsh deposits at Moor Gate and Finsbury Circus. I don't know about you, but I find it quite easy to disassociate the names of various places in London with their literal meaning. And as soon as you think about it, yeah, Moor Gate, the gate to the moor or onto the moor fields, makes perfect sense. I suppose, decontextualised and found in a built-up urban area such as Liverpool Street most certainly is. Very difficult to remember that the name has such a bucolic or agricultural origin. I'm in front of a table now which is decked out with things suggesting urban life from a variety of centuries, from the 1580s onwards. To the left we've got clay pipes. It's very difficult to do too much in London without running into a clay pipe, as anyone will know who has mudlarked. My favourite here, I think, is a domino made from bone or ivory, 18th or 19th century, and dominoes were a relatively common archaeological find. They often found them in the backyards of taverns, and this one was found in Davis Street off Bond Street.
We're really pleased to be able to put these kind of initial results together for the general public tomorrow. We're holding a one-day exhibition and hoping to invite a lot of members of the public through the door to see what we've been finding on the project. One of the very important legacy objectives of the project is to really share this information. Some of the finds we've got here are making a real difference to London's archaeology and what we understand about it. You'll notice just by looking around the room, starting there by the door, the earliest finds we've made are around 68,000 years old. We understand from dating of the soils, bison bones were found in. We also have a piece of very rare amber. So that's where the story starts and then progresses around the room, literally to the 20th century, 100 years ago, with the closing of the Thames Ironworks Shipbuilding Company, once the largest shipbuilder in London on the River Lee, and sadly went out of business in 1912, 100 years ago actually, precisely, due to competitive forces with the great yards of the North East and Scotland. So shipbuilding left London at that point. The shipbuilding yard and Paddington, they share a very important engineering history for the Crossrail project. The Thames Ironworks was a world first in producing iron ships, and those innovative vessels went on to have a kind of world-level impact, really, on the world's navies and therefore the power politics of the late 19th century and early 20th centuries. And they also produced a lot of the ironwork for Brunel structures, which dotted around Britain. So there was a first in engineering, which Crossrail are kind of proudly building on. The second particular site I wanted to mention was the Paddington Great Western Railway, another great Brunel first, the first long-distance railway in the world. And there again, Crossrail is working very closely with his original station to obviously modernise and enhance it, produce a new ticket hall, but paying great respect as well to the original Victorian engineering. So those are kind of two very recent sites, very closely connected with the project, which we just wanted to highlight. In between the very ancient Ice Age finds and those two Victorian sites I just mentioned, a whole range of different stuff you can see, the public are going to be able to see around the room tomorrow. We've got two sites right in the middle of Roman London, just at Liverpool Street, and also Farringdon. Both those sites are very closely associated with the ancient city of London and, of course, the medieval city as well. We then, if you imagine, the West End and the Near East End today being greenfields still in the 16th century, we then have a number of sites which look at that big kind of expansion of urbanism out from the centre into these areas now fully part of the heart of the city. So we're charting, you know, the complete growth in these results. These are preliminary results. We've been working for 3 years mainly on the initial investigations. And what I mean by that is we dig trial pits first to understand what's at each location, and then we'll be coming back over the next 3 years to look at many of these places in a greater area and a greater level of detail. So what we're showing the public this weekend is a kind of small snapshot, really, of what we expect to find in the long-term duration of the project. Okay, thanks very much.
Thank you.
So I'm with Jay Carver now, who is heading up the archaeology side of things.
Yeah, I'm the project archaeologist for Crossrail, so I'm kind of overseeing the archaeology programme.
So you have a team of archaeologists under you?
We've got a large team of archaeologists working on the project. I think we added it up the other day, actually, in anticipation of that question. And I think 150 archaeologists have worked on all the kind of research in terms of the early years of the project, and also through with the design teams who've kind of carefully designed the railway where possible to minimise impacts on the archaeology. There's a whole series of archaeologists who worked with the engineers at that stage, and then we've got a small team with myself in the project office, and then of course quite a large team of archaeologists from Oxford Archaeology and Museum of London out there on the sites doing the work.
And that must be a logistical issue then, because all of this is happening more or less simultaneously.
Yeah, I mean, it generally has to happen with construction. Of course, a lot of these are existing buildings before we start the construction work. We did manage to get investigations through the basements of some buildings before they were demolished.
But again, you're still working, just in terms of the general life cycle of the construction of all these different places, you know, within a yep. year or so, you're going to be spread pretty thin, right?
Yeah, I mean, not everything's happening at once. Crossrail's kind of a phased construction project, so we tend to kind of move in a wave across London. So we haven't been overstretched so far. The big issue we've got is some of the very significant sites we have, such as Liverpool Street, do need very careful planning in terms of the timing. With the construction phase, we'll have certain amounts of time agreed where we've got to go in there, finish the dig as quickly as we can, but of course as well as we can as well.
If I was hoping to home in on conflict, it's got to the obvious place to go is between the archaeologists and the people doing the construction, because they want you to hurry up and get out of the way, don't they?
Essentially, yeah, their job is to build the railway. And, you know, in some cases we could be seen as an impediment to that. But it's a very close working team in Crossrail. All the companies have come together in a single office. So we plan very carefully, and we hold a lot of kind of pre-construction meetings to really work out how long is needed, what can be moved around to accommodate the archaeology work. So we're hoping for a smooth ride.
And it seems to me like however much planning you do, there must be variables thrown up by what you discover that throw the plans out of whack in some direction or other.
Yeah, there's always unexpected discoveries. We're here at the exhibition now. One of those was the discovery of these animal remains from a very long time ago, the bison bones and the reindeer bones.
Yeah, right, these are fantastic. 68,000 years old?
68,000 years old, we estimate. This is from dating the soils in which they were found. That was a classic case of an unexpected discovery, although we had an archaeologist on site because we knew it was possible to make this type of find. When we actually found it, it was right at the end of the excavation process before the first tunnel boring machine needed to get in place. So that was certainly a rush. Mm.
So I'm going to ask a really stupid question now. I can see that different people involved in archaeology have different specialisms, different eras or time periods that they're going to be specialist in. Do you need to have everybody on site all at once because your, I don't know, Georgian London person isn't necessarily going to recognise the significance of your ancient bone of a leg of an animal?
That's an interesting question. We don't, is the short answer. We have specialists of all types kind of on call. The archaeologists who are doing the monitoring on site are kind of highly experienced. It's not a job for someone just new in their career to take on board the monitoring work.
So is like a GP. You've got the GP as the gatekeeper and then specialist.
I think that's quite a good analogy. The GP is the field archaeologist who spends his time dealing with many different periods, because he or she tends to move around different sites, different cities, getting a very good experience and a good feel for all periods. And then when necessity arises, we call in those particular specialists to give advice and do the detailed recording.
And do you get very hands-on yourself, or are you paperwork bound?
I've been around a couple of decades, I suppose, doing archaeology, so I've also got a good GP background, as you put it. I tend these days to visit sites maybe once a week, just to see for myself what we've discovered, so I know how to translate that back into the kind of management process. Yeah.
What's here? What would you like most to blow the trumpet about?
I think the work we've been doing on the Thames Ironworks shipyard is exceptional.
Right, yeah, I was reading about this. Was 6-8 months ago. This became public knowledge, didn't it?
Yeah, that's right. The reason I think it's exceptional is because it's only 100 years old, but it's been lost and forgotten already. And it was an amazingly important site for the people of Canning Town. It employed thousands of people. You know, a lot of local people will have, you know, ancestors who worked there. And it's kind of been forgotten. And I think rediscovering it during the Crossrail Works is a really nice opportunity to bring that site. It's very important history, of kind of world-class importance due to the work it was doing, you know, back into the public consciousness. And, you know, for Canning Town, I hope that's going to be a very positive outcome.
And finally, does this moment in the Crossrail project mark a particular point of achievement for you? Is your work going to start to diminish now as it goes forward?
No, not really. I think this really marks about halfway through the archaeology programme. This is the culmination of about 3 years' work on investigating different sites. And we've still got about another 3 years' work to do to complete the rest of the areas we really haven't started looking at yet. So this is a halfway point. It's a celebration of we've found a lot so far. We're sharing that with the public now. And we take that as a very important obligation to make sure people hear about these finds early and they don't have to wait 6 years for a book to come out before they can read about the finds.
Well, thanks very much for allowing us to see all this stuff.
You're welcome.
Thanks,
Jeff. Very, very interesting to talk to you. Thanks.
Mid-80s, yeah.
I've spotted Caroline Derry over by the... Are you looking at my clinker-built boat?
I am, yes.
What do you make of it? It's quite a large and very recognisable fragment, really, isn't it?
It is. It's amazing to see a piece like that. And also interesting to watch the conservation in process. They're having to keep it damp because obviously it's from the river.
I was speculating earlier that it might be somebody wandering up with a watering can, and it basically was.
Pretty much. Slightly finer spray, but a watering can nonetheless.
What have you seen elsewhere in the exhibition that's caught your attention?
Some amazing old Cross and Blackwell jars. There's one of mushroom catsup, which looks intriguing.
Oh, should we go and have a look? Okay. I haven't seen these yet. This seems very... I can't quite place my finger on what the link is, but you do ghost signs, of course, and you've got a wide collection of pictures of ghost signs. This seems very much in keeping with that.
Absolutely, although ghost signs are my main interest. The old advertising material and so on is always fascinating. And this is a... most of a bottle of Cross and Blackwell's mushroom catsup, now empty, but the label's mostly survived on it, and it's amazing.
And it's a paper label as well, isn't it?
Yes, and very detailed. Lots of wording, not much pictures. 19th to 20th century, but...
It looks kind of Victorian, doesn't it?
It does.
And what else have we got? Here we've got some Dundee marmalade, if you fancy a bit of that. The Seville Orange Marmalade from John Muir and Son, prepared under patent, very important. More Cross and Blackwell. I think this is testament to the strength of Cross and Blackwell's jars.
Yes, there's one for household jam, which sounds quite ominous.
It does, it's like when you go for a curry and it's meat curry.
Yeah, very much the same.
Very non-specific. How are things going on the blog, by the way? We should pass you by without a plug for the blog, for goodness sake.
Pretty well, although it's had a quiet week or so because I've just got back off holiday, but lots more about to come.
Remind us of the URL, would you?
It's Caroline LD.
You've been on holiday and you couldn't remember your URL for a moment.
I couldn't. So it's carolinld.blogspot.com.
And probably soon to feature some pictures of Cross and Blackwell jars, I suspect.
Absolutely.
Well, I think I've discovered a tombstone. I could be proven wrong in just a moment, but I'm with Robert Hartle. He is the senior archaeologist.
A senior archaeologist,
yes, before we get into trouble with the other senior archaeologists. And you said you've had a hand in most of what we see here.
Yeah, I've excavated most of these sites in one capacity or another.
So you're actually there day on day with the toothbrush or whatever it might be, uncovering this stuff?
Yeah, with the trowel, yeah. Don't use toothbrushes very often.
I don't know, I have this idea that you go at sort of a snail's pace and you just gradually brush away the soil.
It's fairly rapid. We have to be careful and delicate in certain areas. You have to be delicate and careful with skeletons, obviously. Mm.
This is a really silly question, but just to prove that I've never done anything remotely archaeological at all. As you're digging down, how do you know how sort of hard to press and whether you can really go at it or whether you've got to take away a layer by it? Because some of these things are really quite fragile. It would only take one wrong move, surely.
Mm. You get a feel for what it is you're digging. Sometimes you get dumps of soil that are obviously just big meter thick dumps of soil that someone's thrown down to consolidate the ground, for example, and that you can dig quite quickly and easily.
So as you're looking at the soil, you kind of get a sense you're seeing the different soil types that are going on there.
Yeah. I mean, you can see water lane deposits or dump deposits, leveling deposits, or cemetery. A cemetery soil has a particular look and feel. With the bones and the burials within the ground, it gets a certain organic brown quality.
That's one of the creepiest things I've heard for a while, actually.
I'm sorry.
I don't think that's the first time you've deployed that line. I think you know the power of that information.
No, I haven't really said that before, but yes.
Well, okay, in future, if you really want to creep somebody out, there's a certain feel to cemetery soil. But maybe that leads us... This is a tombstone, right?
It's a grave marker, probably. Only one face is worked. The other face is rough, so it probably would have been laid on the ground. Obviously, it's fragmented. It's not all of it. We're missing quite a few portions.
All I can see is aged 23. That's the only clear bit to my eye.
23 weeks. This is... It's a bit fragmented, and we've lost a lot of the writing, but it looks like it says John Bale, possibly son of John Bale, something or other, age 25 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously not years, 25 weeks. This is it's a young infant we're talking about here. Died the 13th of April, 1664. So a year or two before the Great Plague and the Fire of London.
And we've got lots of other much smaller objects alongside this great big slab, this cracked slab. And some of them look a bit like they might be tool handles, perhaps?
Yeah, there's a variety of handles, various types of different workings. Represented here is the whole process of worked animal bone. You've got the animal bones themselves, and then they're broken down and turned on the lathe. Pegs for musical instruments, various... This here is from a fan, from a lady's fan.
Oh, I see. How on earth can you tell that?
Well, as you see, it's got this rivet pivot bit.
Oh, I see where the handles meet at the bottom there. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a wig curler, a ceramic wig curler, apparently. I didn't know this.
This is about the same. Well, it's sort of bigger at each end, as a sort of vaguely dumbbell shaped piece of bone, is it?
It's ceramic. It's pottery, a couple of metal items we have as well: a buckle and a rose-shaped mount. Would have been riveted onto something leather, perhaps, or a bit of clothing or something.
It actually looks as though the metal stuff has come off worst from its transition through time. Some of the other pieces look as though they've come through more or less intact.
Yeah, we've had the higher up deposits. The lower deposits are more waterlogged, the Roman deposits. We've had some really nice finds, metal finds from the Roman layers. But these higher up deposits, hasn't been kept as waterlogged, so they've corroded quite badly. This coffin handle, for example, that's you can just about tell what it is, but it's very badly corroded.
And did these all come from the same site as you drilled down through the site, or whereabouts are these ones?
This is
from
this table. All the finds on this table are from the same site. Not the same trenches, but the same site. But this represents several hundred years of history. The latest things are probably from the early 18th century, and the earliest things we have are medieval.
You're pointing out looks like a decorative tile of some kind.
Yeah, it's a decorated floor tile.
And are these completely mixed up, or are they found more or less in sort of clusters that belong together in some way?
No, most of these are spread out through the site. Some of these earlier finds are in the marsh deposits beneath the cemetery. So they would have been just rubbish that had been thrown down and got mixed up in the marsh. And the rest of the stuff is from the cemetery horizon, in amongst the backfills of graves. It's interesting. I mean, some of this material, the worked bone, is probably has arrived there as a consequence of fly tipping. It's just stuff that's been thrown away into the cemetery, and it's just worked its way. It's been when they've been digging to inter people, this has worked its way into the backfills of the graves.
What's the sign for you? Because I presume now and again you must hit on something that's more exciting than your average find. What's the first inkling that you get that you're onto something?
Probably when it's uncovered. I mean, it is quite often you can't tell that you're about to hit something exciting. Sometimes the last phase of work we did in Liverpool Street, there was something cut into the ground. There was a shape, a square shape, and it looked like it was going to be a pit. So I knew that was probably potentially a Roman rubbish pit. So there could be interesting finds thrown into there, or a ditch, say, some sort of linear feature that's you can see in the soil. And again, I mean, you can always find interesting things within ditches, but other things like walls, perhaps. You don't know until they're there until you're on top of them and they're exposed and there you are.
Very interesting. I was trying to figure out where a future archaeologist would want to look for information about our time, and we've made it pretty easy with these big landfill sites, haven't we?
Yeah, they're going to be there for quite some time, I should think. And lots of a huge variety of everyday rubbish for people to sift through in the future.
Where do you suppose they're going to look? I can understand there's ditches. Have we got an equivalent of ditches or bits of ground where we get rid of this kind of stuff now? Do we do the same sort of thing?
Canals, I suppose. I mean, they're not. Most canals aren't a Victorian, perhaps, but they will have had 150 years of rubbish being thrown into them. Although they're going to, I suppose, they dredge them. They maybe clean them out every so often. Mm.
I wonder if are we a little bit too clean? I mean, even as we're digging up for a new building here, we're taking an awful lot of out of the soil. We're taking the stories out from underneath it. Are we leaving much behind? I don't know.
Every inch of London would have been covered in interesting archaeology. It sort of gets whittled away by developments. And the Victorians were very careless. They just dug wherever they fancied and didn't carefully record what they found. But
that seems so counterintuitive when it comes to the Victorians. I thought they'd be much more methodical than that.
No, I don't know. I think the discipline of archaeology was in its infancy back then, and there were lots of nice discoveries and interesting things, but a lot of it just got dug away without any thought about future generations and the fact that they might be interested in what's being thrown away.
My final question, what would be the ideal, if you had a dream location to do some archaeology, is there a particular place you'd love to get underneath or inside? Or
not sure. Tricky. I mean, there's lots of lovely places potentially still underneath London. Lots of the old city still surviving underneath modern buildings and roads.
So just a question of time.
Yeah. I mean, unfortunately, a lot of the roads, for example, you very rarely get a chance to excavate under them because they've been roads for hundreds of years, and there probably will be roads for hundreds of years after that. So no one's going to build a building in the middle of a road. Having said that, Crossrail, we wouldn't be excavating in Liverpool Street if the Crossrail project wasn't happening.
Right.
because they're putting their station in there, that gives us the opportunity to examine this area, this particular area that hasn't really been touched that much.
Oh, so it is all potentially still up for grabs then, and presumably something like the Second World War, with big chunks of land being sort of tossed up by explosives and all that, that must have given an opportunity for people to get in and see stuff they wouldn't normally have seen as well.
Yeah, a lot of the Blitz damage did give the opportunity, redevelopment gave the opportunity for people to get in there and have a look at sites that have been covered for hundreds of years. And yeah,
I heard they found a church in the Blitz. Have you heard about this? Down by Moorgate, and you can see it's not very much, it's about as big as that area just over there. I'm gesturing towards a small area, and there's just the bottom corner of the church, but yeah, apparently it was uncovered by bombing, and now they know where it is. There we go. What is it, Robert? Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, this isn't the biggest room in the world, and there is an awful lot packed in here. There's even, although nobody seems to have paid it any heed at all, what looks like a demonstration of how one does archaeology. So it's like a sandpit, basically, with some tools and brushes, and a dustpan and brush here. So we could pretend to be an archaeologist for the day if we wanted. A great exhibition. I do hope that this is going to pop up again in this form, and perhaps with some of the new finds as the Crossrail excavation goes on.
Catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well,
HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.